Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled The How-To's of Social Entrepreneurship. We certainly welcome all our audience here this evening and invite you to visit us often on the Internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers who will be sharing their thoughts with us this evening. The professional career of Wilford Welch has been devoted to understanding and taking actions to address global challenges. As a U.S. diplomat in Asia, as a professor of international business, as a publisher of a world affairs publication, and as an international business consultant. In 2004, he co-founded the Quest for Global Healing Initiative with Desmond Tutu. It brings thousands of people together from around the world to help transform their concerns over environmental and social challenges into concrete initiatives. The next gathering, entitled Beyond Sustainability, Creating a Culture of Leadership, Built on a Platform of Reverence, will take place in Hawaii in June of 2010. The book he wrote with David Hopkins, entitled The Tactics of Hope, How Social Entrepreneurs Are Changing Our World, seeks to inspire and support individuals to become part of the solution. Wilford has degrees from Yale, Harvard, and the University of California at Berkeley, and lives in Sausalito. David Hopkins is an emerging social entrepreneur, keynote speaker, and published writer. He is the contributing editor and co-writer with Wilford Welch of The Tactics of Hope. While at Middlebury College, he serves as director of the International Affairs Center of the Roosevelt Institution, the nation's first student think tank devoted to progressive policy reform. And he graduated cum laude in the International Studies, Politics, and Economics. He's a regular writer for the Skoll Foundation's Social Edge blog and is a founding director of BeRewarding.com, an incentive-based education website that generates donations to leading social and environmental nonprofit organizations. David has worked with communities in Cambodia, France, Tanzania, and Greece, and now lives here in San Francisco. Lynn Twist is a global activist, fundraiser, speaker, consultant, and author. She has spent more than three decades working in positions of leadership with many global initiatives, including ending world hunger, protecting the world's rainforests, empowering indigenous peoples, improving health, economic, and political conditions for women and children, advancing the scientific understanding of human consciousness, and creating a sustainable future for all of life. She is the author of the award-winning best-selling book, The Soul of Money, the president and founder of the Soul of Money Institute, and is the co-founder with her husband, Bill, of the Pachamama Alliance. She is a graduate of Stanford University and did graduate work at the University of California at Irvine. She lives with her husband, Bill, here in San Francisco and in Quito, Ecuador. Would you please join me in first welcoming Wilford Welch?
Thank you, Tom. I'm going to get right into it because we only have an hour. We have three speakers, and we got a lot to say, and we have a lot of Q&A. Hopefully, it'll start at 6:40. The first thing that I really want to talk about is what I'm going to do here is I'm going to talk about what is a social entrepreneur, and I'm going to give you a number of examples to sort of lay the framework for all of that. And then Lynn's going to come up and talk about the Pachamama Alliance, which is one of the 27 social entrepreneurs and the initiatives that's in the Tactics of Hope. And then David Hopkins, who really is basically the co-author of this book with me. I mean, we worked hand in glove for a year and a half solidly on this book, is going to speak about really the power of that his next generation to also be part of the solution, not the problem. And then at 6:40, hopefully, we're going to have some Q&A. So I'm going to quickly say why I wrote this book, and it is really grounded in this gathering that many of you know about called Quest for Global Healing that Desmond Tutu was very involved in, that Carol, my wife, and myself and one other person from Sausalito helped create, and Lynn played a very important role in. And three things came out of those gatherings, of which 1,000 people from 40 countries showed up and really demonstrated. Well, let me tell you what the three are, because that's what I'm going to talk about. One is I was awed by how many people under the radar are already doing extraordinary things. I really hadn't realized how powerful that is. The second thing that awed me and impressed me was the power of young people who are very well informed, are action oriented, and are really taking responsibility for their role in bringing about the shift in awareness and the actions around the sustainability issue. And David's, of course, going to be talking about that. And the third is, and this is really the reason why I wrote with David The Tactics of Hope, is how many people are out there who are really concerned and want to be part of the solution but don't know how to move from concern to passion to vision to action that speaks to them and that they will carry forward and really make a difference. So the book was really focused on supporting them in moving from concern to action. Yeah. So the first thing that I want to talk about here now is, if I can get this thing going, is I'm going to give you some examples of social entrepreneurs, and the first one is Playpunts. So the problem was that in Africa particularly, the average woman, and it usually is a woman, has to walk for 3 miles every day to get clean water. The second point is that 50,000 people die every day around the world from a lack of clean water. So here are these I gave the wrong slide. This is Iqbal Khadr. And Iqbal Khadr from Bangladesh recognized the problem was that in the rural areas of Bangladesh, people had no access to any kind of telecommunications because the government of Bangladesh had no interest in providing this kind of service out in the rural areas. So Iqbal started thinking about the question of how connectivity will increase productivity. So he had that ability to think about that. And he therefore, over a number of years, created a cell phone company and connected 60,000 villages with giving phone ladies, poor villagers in these rural areas, cell phones that they could then use to earn money by you giving and selling phone minutes to other people in villages in Bangladesh. He then sold, after 7 years, that company with his partners for $33 million. So it's a very good example of doing good, addressing a social or environmental problem, and doing well at the same time. That's an example of one of those phone letters. Now, the second one that I just was starting to talk about is Playpunts. The problem that these two guys were addressing was the fact that these women have to walk so far that 50,000 people die every day from a lack of clean water. And they said, how about if we take pumps and we put pumps in the ground, we build a hole in the ground, we put hydraulic pumps there, and then we get some of the village children to turn the pumps and have a good time doing that. And then they will pump the water, and as you'll see on the right-hand side of that slide, they have a water tank there, and they are able to put advertising on those on that and earn money sufficient to pay for the maintenance. Okay, so that's a second example of thinking out of the box, solving a social problem with high-tech or low-tech to address a social or environmental challenge. So let's talk, and then I'll show you some more of these examples, but let's talk about some of the characteristics that David and I found when we started looking at these 27 examples and others of social entrepreneurs. One, they're unlike business. If you think of a business entrepreneur, you have someone whose primary objective, they don't really care what business they're in, they're interested in making a profit for their family and for their lives. Okay. A social entrepreneur is using many of the same techniques, but seeking to solve a social or environmental problem. Their objective is primarily to solve a problem. They may want to earn money at the same time. That's great, but that's not their primary objective. They often seek systemic solutions. Bill Drayton, who is really the founder of this movement, who runs Ashoka out of Washington and has Ashoka Fellows all over the world. I love his quote. He basically says, social entrepreneurs don't give you a fish. Social entrepreneurs don't teach you how to fish. Social entrepreneurs change the fishing system. Okay? That doesn't mean that social entrepreneurs don't give fish and teach people to fish. He's basically saying that they think in systemic terms. If we've got a problem right around the corner on homelessness, how do we create an approach to homelessness that is not going to just help John off the street, but he's going to help thousands of people via a fundamental shift in the approach? They often think out of the box. David likes to use the word boundary ride. But they are thinking not in their stovepipe ways of just, if I've got a nail, I've got a hammer because I'm someone that uses hammers. They're thinking about different ways of combining technologies to solve, or other ways to solve, a social or environmental problem. They love scalability when it's appropriate. In other words, if you're going to try and bring about systemic change, you have to scale. Look what Iqbal Khadr did with Grameen Phone. If you only have one woman who has a phone, you don't have much of a telephone system. If you got 60,000 people connected, and that ultimately affected 100,000 people in Bangladesh through his work, and they became the largest telephone company, and it is in Bangladesh, because of his thinking about mobile phones and how you bank on the poor by providing them a phone. Okay. They collaborate across boundaries. They don't get stuck in their stovepipes. And the last that I want to mention, or I have two more, is they don't really care whether they're for-profit, non-profit, or a hybrid. Okay. Now, Bonnie, you and I came in the car, and you said they're only for-profit. We'll talk about that on the car going out. Okay. I'll also mention two other things that social entrepreneurs that are characteristics that I think are important. And one is that they use, to the extent they can, market forces to solve that problem. A market force is really people who need water. Market force may be people who need to telecommunicate. Okay? So they're trying to harness their solutions to what people's needs are. The second thing that I should mention is they love to give their ideas away. A business entrepreneur isn't going to share his or her plans for how they're going to make money. A social entrepreneur says, you want my plans for play pumps so that you can do it in another country? Not a problem. I have to go very fast because of all the things that we're trying to cover with three speakers. So after we had the 27 social entrepreneurs written up in the book, we said, what are some of the characteristics that are common and shared among these different organizations? All social entrepreneurial organizations, despite what I've just been sort of implying, don't all look the same. So if we start at the sort of at 2 o'clock right there, you see scalability. Some, and this happens to be one of the 27 in the book called Rugmark, which is focusing in on solving slave labor in the carpet industry in South Asia. And some initiatives are highly scalable and others are less scalable. Okay, so that's fairly scalable. The second is, how easy is it to enter? Iqbal Khadr had a heck of a time entering the telephone business and getting a license from the Bengali government to enter that. Okay, he had to raise a huge amount of capital. High risk, got a big return, $33 million out of it. But his entry was high. Immediacy of results, you can imagine. Some are very quick. Search for common ground, they may never get a return in terms of this incredible work that they're doing. Public concern or public support. Some are very, very like Room to Read, John Wood. Many of you know John Wood here in town, creating libraries, particularly in Asia. Everybody loves to help children. But Karen Che and the work she's doing with prisoners in China and Cambodia, she has a hard time getting anybody interested in helping people who are in prisons in those countries. So there's very little public support for those kind of things. Operational self-sustainability. Okay, some are able to generate revenue that make them self-sustaining, and others have to rely primarily on other people giving them money, which is the more traditional model. Okay. But that's a social entrepreneur works pretty darn hard trying to figure out what are some streams of revenue that will mean that they can be self-sustaining, if not profitable. The next one is startup capital intensivity, and the last one, or next to the last one, is internet intensivity. Now, the example that I'm going to use of Kiva in a moment is very internet intensive. If it didn't have the internet, Kiva wouldn't be alive. And then the other question is replicability. Some are highly replicable. You could take plate pumps and create it in 27 countries in Africa. You can take mobile phones like Grameen Phone and do that, and it is happening all over the world after Iqbal did the test. Now, I bet if I asked you to raise your hand how many people knew Kiva, everybody would probably raise their hand. Okay? It was Jessica Flannery and Matt Flannery, who started it right out of business school in Stanford. They recognized that the problem was that the poor, like in Grameen Phone, the poor didn't have access to money to be able to buy things. And they banked on the poor, but what they did is they found you, who were really concerned about helping someone abroad to start a business. The average loan now is $466. They have now, in 4 years, they now have $66 million of loans that have come in. They have a 98% repayment rate. 97% of those people are women. Okay, and 3.4 people that give money get it back and then give it out again. It's all done by the internet. It's very efficient, nonprofit, and it is addressing a critical social or environmental issue with technology and with a lot of brains. A new way of thinking about things. Okay? Those are just examples of women in this case that are earning loans. World of Good. Many of you know Priya Haji. She is in Emeryville. She's half Indian, half Kenyan. By her background, the problem that she's addressing is women in poor countries that are giving handicrafts, making handicrafts, and who have a middleman who they have no bargaining power with, and the women have no access to market. She's focusing on solving the market problem particularly, and so she went to Whole Foods. And she said, how about putting a kiosk up there? And we'll educate consumers about that their purchasing power is going to help a woman in get out of poverty in places like Guatemala and all the rest. She created a for-profit company, and 10% of that for-profit company goes to the nonprofit foundation that then works to try and help those artisans. So, again, it's thinking out of the box, focusing on a social or environmental problem any which way, that's so long as it's legal. Then there's Van Jones. If I asked anybody didn't know Van Jones, no one would put up their hand, okay? So Van, who's now in the White House, really recognized that there was a serious problem in terms of our underprivileged populations that don't have maybe as much education, access to jobs and skills. And he said, wow, we've got an environmental problem. We've got a whole group of people who could get to work if they had the right skills. How about if we combine those things and we'll solve somewhat oil dependence, global warming, and a social problem at home if we provide these jobs. Obama thought that was a hell of an idea, and he's now in the White House exactly doing that. Okay, that's thinking out of the box. That's not for profit, but that is thinking out of the box and combining different things in a fundamentally different way. And now we have an organization called Pachamama, which Bill Twist back there and Lynn Twist right here founded, and they're in the book. And I'm not going to talk about Pachamama Alliance very much because we have Bill Twist right there down in Ecuador. We have Lynn Twist over there. And then we have our next speaker right there, Lynn Twist. Thank you very much.
Have any slides, so I, if it's okay to use this mic so you don't notice I don't have any slides, I'll stand right here. First of all, Wilfred, thank you so much for including me in your presentation. My husband Bill and I are the co-founders of the Pachamama Alliance, and the word Pachamama means the earth, the sky, the universe, and all time. a shorter way of saying that is Mother Earth, but it's a Quechua word. The Quechua people live in the Andes and in the Amazon, and for them, their understanding of reality is very, very large. So Pachamama means larger than Mother Earth to them. And it's an alliance between indigenous peoples of the Amazon and conscious, committed, modern world people like everyone here. And it's an alliance for the sustainability of life on Earth. Wilfred had on one of his beautiful slides a little piece of our mission. And we work with indigenous peoples in the Amazon, primarily the Achuars, are kind of the foundation of our work is the Achuar people, but we also work with the Shuar, the Shiwiar, the Sequoia, the Zaporo people, many indigenous groups and indigenous federations in the Ecuadorian Amazon and also in other countries that stretch across the Amazon jungle, all the way across South America. And this work came to us in a kind of mystical way. That's a wonderful story that doesn't fit in my 10 minutes. But it was a time in both my husband Bill's life and in my life, probably like your own, where we didn't have a free minute. We were raising three children. Bill was running several different companies. I was responsible for fundraising on a global level for an organization called the Hunger Project. So I was managing fundraising operations in something like 37, 40 countries. I hardly had time to go to sleep at night or, you know, do anything, let alone take on another project. But circumstances and mystical experiences and dreams and requests and timing and magic led us to the Ecuadorian rainforest in 1995. And out of an encounter with the Achuar people in a very remote area of the Amazon, the Pachamama Alliance was born. And it was inconvenient. So I just want to say to those of you who are aspiring social entrepreneurs or already are a social entrepreneur, it's actually very inconvenient. It doesn't fit in a normal life. Usually there's a huge commitment that wells up in your soul, in your heart, in your mind. You can't stop thinking about it. You can't work on anything else. Everything else goes to the back burner. And you start doing things you never expected to be doing. And Bill and I, for us, we call ourselves the foundees rather than the founders of the Pachamama Alliance, because the Pachamama Alliance founded us. It founded us. It rearranged our lives. We didn't see it as our plan for ourselves. We hadn't even been to South America. We didn't speak Spanish. But it became clear to us in this encounter with the Achuar in 1995 that although it wasn't our plan for our lives, it was clearly our destiny. And so ultimately, after a little bit of resistance, a lot more on my part than Bill's, we surrendered, and now it's the focus and center of both of our lives. And we have a twofold mission, and I'm going to tell you that because this call, really, that came to us, we call it a call, came from, at first it seemed like from the Achuar, this remote indigenous group in the Amazon, came into our lives in a way that was interruptive, unexpected, and a little bit challenging to respond to. But as we began our work with the Achuar people, we began to see that the call came from the rainforest, through the Achuar people, and we were lucky enough to hear it and respond. But as we worked even more deeply with the indigenous peoples of the rainforest, we actually began to see that the call came through the Achuar, through the rainforest, from the spirit of life itself. So out of that recognition and out of that realization, I wanted to share with you our twofold mission. First, to preserve the Earth's tropical rainforest by empowering the indigenous people who are its natural custodians. That's the primary fundamental insight of the Pachamama Alliance. Empowering indigenous people to protect those forests is the most effective, most powerful way to protect our natural resources that we call the Amazon. And secondly, the second part of our mission is to contribute to the creation of a new global vision of equity and sustainability for life, for all forms of life, for all children of all species, for all time, as Bill McDonough would say. And the second part of our mission is realized not in the Amazon, not working with indigenous people, but comes from a request those indigenous people made of us in the very beginning of our encounter with them. And that was that the most important work we can do, and this really is the central point I want to leave you with in this evening about social entrepreneurship, the most important work they said people like us, including you in this room, could do is to change the dream of the modern world. To change the dream of the modern world. Now, if you think about what that means, that's a big assignment. And at first we didn't know how to respond or in what way we could respond. But then we began to see we needed to do something. Because the dream of the modern world, as the indigenous people saw so clearly, is a trance that we're all caught in, that sometimes we'll realize we're in a trance and sometimes we're just in it. But as awake as people in this room are, we are still in the trance. And indigenous people are outside of that trance, and they can see that we're in it. They're not making us wrong for that, but they can help us wake up. And the trance, or the dream, is becoming a nightmare for ourselves and all forms of life. And we know that now. So out of that, we created a program called Awakening the Dreamer, Changing the Dream. And it's a half-day symposium whose mission says it all. And the mission of the symposium is this: to bring forth an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, and socially just human presence on this planet. And so we have worked for years now with the indigenous people. And out of that very, very profound relationship with people who are not caught in the trance, who live in complete harmony with one another and the natural world, we have developed the symposium. And I invite you all to participate. And then finally, I would like to just say that this word social entrepreneur refers, I think, to the largest movement in human history, which is the emergence of civil society. It is the largest participation event in the history of our species. It's larger than any world war. More people are participating in organizations, institutions, initiatives, projects that are building a better world than any time in previous history. It is the Earth's immune system kicking in. It is what I call not the nonprofit world or the profit-making world or the non-governmental world or the business world, but this social entrepreneur movement is people who are working for social profit. Fine if they can make money too, but the real goal is a social profit. And those people, I say, are the social prophets of our time. PROPHET. Social prophets of our time. Please join us. Thank you.
Wow. I have now been to two Pachamama luncheons, and I heard Paul Hawken, who many of you know for writing with Amory and Hunter Levin's Natural Capitalism and more recently Blessed Unrest, he said that the Pachamama Alliance, I don't know where he got this, but he said it, is the most important NGO in the world right now. That's coming from a guy who knows what he's talking about because he's chronicled all of them. I'm going to talk to you about the power of millennial youth as transformative agents of change. And I'm going to move pretty quickly through these, so bear with me. This is a quote that I got from one of my business partners, Morgan Fitzgibbons, who quoting here Buckminster Fuller, says, "Children are elders in universal time." I love this quote. That's largely the theme of what I'm talking about, and it has much to do with what Lynn and Wilfred have talked about, intergenerational collaboration for the future of generations. So the three steps that I'm going to tell you quickly about are who we are, where we are at now, and where we're going. Let me stop and ask, how many of you have heard the term millennial before, the millennial generation? Wow, a lot of you. How many of you would consider yourself millennials? Okay. Well, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about who we are for those of you who are not millennials. We're optimistic, not pessimistic or vengeful. We're tolerant, diverse, and more mature, ha, maybe, than predecessor generations. We certainly are more diverse. We are aware of and realistic about the challenges and more knowledgeable in our worldview than arguably any generation before. We are children of globalization. We believe in technology and our ability to innovate out of the mess we are inheriting. We embrace plenitude, but we reject disparity. There's enough to go around for all of us. We're exhausted with punditry and bickering that we see on the news, talking heads, but we are energized by what we see in other leaders that are post-partisan, post-ideological, and post-political, these values we hold dear. Most importantly, we believe in the greater good and are dedicating ourselves to achieving it. This is where we're at now, okay? A little bit about where we've been for the last 50 years. Larry Brilliant, who's the head of Google.org, said, "We're all going so fast, but where are we going?" And where we've been and where we're at is a consumer culture of more is better. And when I say consumer culture, Daniel Pink, who's an author of A Whole New Mind, he says that the storage industry, the storage business, which, what is that? What is that problem? Is that solving? It's how much stuff we have, right? And it's not in our homes. It's in a self-storage space. The self-storage business grosses $21 billion a year. That's more than the motion picture business. That's not a problem my grandparents and great-grandparents had. I have so much stuff as a middle-class family that we need to go find and put in a new place. Right? This is economic expansion at our own peril. It's the military-industrial complex. It's partisanship and political ideologies that are largely getting us into this mess. So we've got these challenges and problems, okay? And let's move them over and talk about solutions and innovations. That's what millennials are doing. So where are we going with that? We have competition. That's been the name of the game for the last 50 years. Once again, let's move competition over. The new name of the game is collaboration. Well, competition's still good. Growth, economic expansion, prosperity for more people. But when you put those two together, you got co-opetition. I think that's really the future of what millennials think about. How do we work together to achieve goals? I just came up with this about an hour ago. Maybe totally corny. It's an acronym. I'm saying where we're going is the task era. The task era. We're not as focused on the problems and the challenges. We're focused on the solutions and the innovations. Technology, abundance and scarcity, knowledge, empathy, the right brain, and action. We're the task era. We are task oriented. We're trying to solve major global problems and challenges. Technology connects us. There's a lot of abundance out there, but yet there's so much scarcity. And it's the interaction between those two that we're trying to bridge the gap. How do we do that? With knowledge. Empathy is something Bill Drayton, who coined the term social entrepreneur, talks frequently about, which is to care for others as if you have to walk in their shoes, and teaching young leaders, emerging leaders, to look in the eyes of those who have less, who are less fortunate, and knowing what it feels like to be there and how to help those people rise up and how to help themselves so that they can teach their generations to do it. That's action. The list of hope goes on and on, okay? These are all organizations dealing and either started by a millennial or that focus on youth empowerment. Look at them go. These are only 50 of millions. You can read a lot of those. Many of you may know we've got Americans for Informed Democracy, Teach for America, the Roosevelt Institution, of which I helped to lead at Middlebury College, YouthWorks. These are organizations giving money and resources to young leaders. The list goes on and on and on. It's inspiring. What is the capitalization gap? This is something that I heard first from Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote Blink, The Tipping Point, and most recently Outliers. The cap gap is the difference between what can be achieved successfully and what is in fact achieved. Tom Friedman said, "An America living in a defensive crouch cannot fully tap the vast rivers of idealism, innovation, volunteerism, and philanthropy that still flow through the world. We need that America more than ever today." That comes from Hot, Flat, and Crowded. Defensive crouch is where we've been over the last 8 years. So what percentage of young people successfully achieve the things that they could? That is the problem that some of my friends and I are really looking to tackle. It's this cap gap. It's the knowledge action gap. This is really more specifically what I'm talking about. The knowledge action gap. The difference between what can be achieved and what is achieved, if only we knew more. Well, we have a solution for that. I thought, what's the problem? It's the knowledge action gap. Yeah, we know all this stuff. We're tired of hearing about the problems on the news, the murders, the global warming, the poverty, the this, the wars. But what are we going to do about it? It's bridging the gap between that knowledge and the action that millennials must be concerned with. So some of my business associates, Xander Page and Morgan Fitzgibbons, who are sitting over there, and I have thought of one solution of many that are out there. Be rewarding. The only website that enables you to change your world simply by learning more about it. How does it work? Go to berewarding.com and you'll see this. Here we have a slide. It says a question for those of you who can't quite read it. In the United States, on average, an average person creates how many pounds of trash per day? That is one of 3,000 questions we have in our system. We ask questions in the categories of water, climate change, energy, poverty, health, education, biodiversity, human rights, and this one comes from human impact. Now, you'll see an advertisement on the bottom and on the far right. You'll see the question. And does anyone know the answer? Xander, Morgan, a little help. The answer is B, 4.39 pounds. So what happens if you get that right? The screen goes green, and guess what happens? A donation from the advertisement on the bottom and the side of the screen goes towards a nonprofit beneficiary partner that's tackling the issue that that question is about. Here we have, conveniently, Beyond Sustainability. Well, Wilford happens to be one of the founders of that. And we also have the Pachamama Alliance, which has not yet signed their papers. Now, I can't, that is a knowledge action gap. The knowledge is out there. We're just trying to give them money. All they have to do is sign.
I think if they don't sign, then you could give it to Beyond Sustainable.
Okay, so we're going to get them to sign. And we've got these wonderful partnerships with Play Pumps in our water category. Guess what? They came from Tactics of Hope. Beyond Sustainability in our human impact category. Pachamama Alliance in biodiversity for their great work in the Amazon rainforest. And we have questions like these to bridge the knowledge action gap. Every time that a user, whether they be an elementary school child, a grad school business student, a 60-year-old mother or grandmother, comes onto our site, they can answer a bunch of questions knowing that every correct answer is going towards a good purpose. This is based off of freerice.com, which many of you may have heard of, which grosses about what they do is they have vocabulary questions. They give about 67 million grains of rice a day, because they give 10 grains of rice for every correct question, at 10 grains of rice per correct answer. So you can do the math. We calculate that they're getting about 500,000 unique visitors every month. Whew. Well, we want to tap the power of the millennials to start introducing models like these. And I will just say that we're launching on Earth Day. It's not yet launched, but our website's up. We're looking for donors, and we're looking for supporters, and we're looking for friends, and we're looking for people to learn to earn for others. Thank you for your time. I look forward to answering any questions about millennial youth.
I want to thank Wilford Wilch and David Hopkins and Lynn Twist for providing us some tantalizing little insights into their work and their efforts. And now we're going to move into a period of Q&A, and I invite you, if you would, to please line up at either of these microphones, and we'll proceed into the Q&A period. And I guess I'll get started, if I may, with kind of a question that maybe address this to all of you and comment on this in terms of what does one actually do, in the sense that can you do this part-time? Do you have to have either won the lottery and be independently wealthy to run off and into these activities, or you can give your energy and your money in various ways, but how do people get involved in these kinds of social entrepreneur ventures?
I think the word social entrepreneur is still being defined, and we just sought to do it in this book, and Skoll does it, and Bill Drayton does it, and all the rest. So it's fairly broad. And some people are devoting, as Lynn has said, are totally devoting their whole lives to these things. And other people are trying, and that's what we're talking about in the book, and I'm not just trying to push the book, trying to get people to meet the challenges and their own passions where they can. And therefore, as Paul Hawken talks about, there is this incredible growth, and Lynn just mentioned it, this incredible growth of private people doing public good. And some are trying to change the whole world, and some are trying to separate the trash for the first time. Now, I realize that someone separating the trash is sort of part of the civil society movement, but not really a social entrepreneur the way I was defining it. Okay? So I think we're trying to meet people where they are, or they need to meet the realities of this world where they can make a difference.
I would say that if you're alive today, you have a role to play in the turning of the tide. And it's not a big role or a small role. It's your role. And I think the times are demanding that we recognize that each of us is someone who can, in their everyday actions, whether they take on and found an organization the way we did, or they write a book the way Wilford did and generate a conference, or they support someone who's doing something like that, or they start their own business, or they become a Kiva donor online, or join this incredible Be Rewarding movement. Whatever it is, that if you start seeing that you can be someone who hospices the death of the old structures and systems that no longer serve us, while we midwife the birth of the new structures and systems that will. And all of us can do that in our lives. It's an everyday thing. The choices we make with our money, the choices we make with our time, the conversations we choose to generate, affirm, and participate in, all have huge impact in the world in which we live and the future that is possible. So I say everybody can play. Everybody's alive at a time when everybody's needed. And whatever role you find that's yours, play it with your heart and play your heart out.
Lynn just kind of blew it out of the water with that response. But I do have one thing to add. And I should say that she's the best-selling author, as was mentioned in her introduction, of The Soul of Money and the Relationship with Money, is a book I urge you all to read. And I'm a little bit of a hypocrite in the advice that I'm about to give, and that is the biggest way in which I think we can all do what Tom said is to be better conscious consumers in what we buy. And I say hypocrite because I buy stuff that is not helping the planet. It's often sourced by people who are not being paid fair wages, and that's what the World of Good, Priya Haji's organization, is tackling. But what we buy, and if anyone can do a green Yelp, it's something that we're even working on with Be Rewarding, a source to learn about products that are sourced correctly, that are paying people fairly, equal equity, and that are sustainably made. That is how we can make a change most immediately in our everyday lives.
Can I just tag on that? There's a book called Greenopia that I recommend, and it's done by college students in San Francisco, and they can tell you exactly where to buy and what to buy and what not to buy. There's one in every city. There's also a little book that you can put in your purse or your pocket called Better World Shopping Guide, which whether you're buying potato chips or film for a camera, film, there's no such thing as film, but whatever it is you're buying, I'm obviously not a millennial. And you can go on New American Dream. There's just so much information now about how to wake up and be a conscious consumer. So I just want to tag that onto what you said.
The author of Better World Shopping Guide is one of Be Rewarding's advisors and is working with us to choose only the most socially and environmentally responsible companies to be our advertisers. The name is Dr. Ellis Jones, the Better World Shopping Guide.
And my last comment is David Hopkins may be a hypocrite and he may be a consumer, but he doesn't have any money right now. So, the plug is, any of you who want to hire this cat, you ought to do it right now.
It's true. I do need a job.
We'll take you. Okay. That's hard to follow. Excuse the non sequitur, but as I heard Lynn talk about this trance, I was reminded of the words from the film Moonstruck, snap out of it. Remember those lines? Well, maybe you're too young.
Sure.
Anyway, my question then is relating to the economic crisis. What potential does it have, and this is for all of you, to help us snap out of it? And how can that potential be realized so this doesn't become a recovery that puts us back to sleep?
Oh, I love that question.
I'm so glad you... Were you a plant? That was good. Well, I'm really into this whole topic. So I wrote a book called The Soul of Money, and as you can tell from the title, it addresses that kind of arena. And to me, the financial crisis is the biggest opportunity I've seen in my lifetime, and I'm not a millennial. It is the unraveling of the monster. It is the unraveling of the structures and systems that are rotten at the core, not rotting at the top, rotting because there is a lie at their heart. And, you know, it's my prayer that we don't recover. Now, that's horrible to say to people who've lost their job and who've lost everything with Bernard Madoff or, you know, don't have their IRA any longer. And, you know, I do feel for all of us, and there's a lot of pain that's going to come with the transformation. But at the same time, you know, we've been able to hold climate change, which is a huge problem, at arm's length in the halls of power, as if it's going to happen, when it's happening right now and we know it. We've been able to hold social justice and social injustice, I mean, at arm's length. It's a crisis. You know, half the people in the world... 3.5 billion people live on less than $2 a day. That is just obscene. Obscene indictment of the human family. But we've held that at arm's length in the halls of power. The spiritual crisis that we talk about in our symposium, which is really a term for mental illness rates, suicide rates, violence in schools, the even obesity rates, the, you know, the kind of lost soul of humanity, you could call the spiritual crisis. We've been able to hold that at arm's length in the halls of power. But here comes the financial crisis. And it's like this. It is not something we can hold at arm's length. And if we recover from this, and I pray that we don't, it's like resuscitating someone who's had lung cancer so that they can smoke again. You know, we need to address the heart of the matter, which is where all of this comes from. And you could say the very root, there's many ways of talking about, but one way is our species has been in overshoot, global overshoot, since 1987. We've been using more resources than the Earth can regenerate since 1987. We now use 30% more than the Earth can regenerate. Our ecological, we're on an ecological credit card that you can't pay back. And that had to show up in the financial structure, and now it has. Plus, we all knew this was going to happen. I mean, didn't you know it was going to happen? So now what is unraveling is that which is unsustainable, that which is inappropriate, that which has no strength at its heart. And so we need to let it fail. And in letting it fail, if you look at what's happening to people, and even the people who've lost, you know, in a way that's so painful they can hardly recover their lives, they are discovering that the behaviors that we all know we should have been taking are the behaviors now that we must take. You know, people carpooling, people turning off the lights, people being dependent on each other, that kind of human value that is genuine wealth, being clear that it's belonging, not belongings, that is the source of our wealth, our relationship with one another, our capacity to live in community and in communion with one another. So as painful as this is, and it's painful, and it's going to get probably worse, it's like, you know, if any of the women are in the audience have had a child, I like to remember when I was in labor, because the more it hurt, the closer I was to having a baby. And we're going through a transformation, I think, that is a birth passage to the new economy, an economy that's equitable, that's fair, that's rooted in something real rather than something false. And I think it's absolutely critical that we begin to recalibrate our relationship with money, whether we're forced to do it, as many, many, many people are being forced, and probably ultimately all of us, or whether we choose to do it, it's what we must do to have a sustainable future for life.
The winner!
Wilford, David, you wanted to add anything to
I wouldn't touch that. That was beautiful.
Well, one of the things we like to do at the Commonwealth Club is to probe and poke these important things in provocative ways. So I guess I have to ask this question. Is it all a lie? Is it all rotten? As we look back over the history of our country and the way we've patted ourselves on the back in terms of the growth of our standard of living and so forth, are we going to be able to be selective, or is it all rotten? Is it all a lie?
Do you have a comment on that?
Me?
Yeah, I mean, do or
you,
David?
You guys take a turn, but yeah. I have lots to say about everything.
I don't want to comment. I mean, obviously, I don't think it's all a lie in the slightest, but I think that we have to make some very – I very much agree with what – and that's what this Beyond Sustainability Gathering is all about. It's bringing those critical people around the world who are going to have to recognize the issues that she's talking about, whether it's government officials or it's university presidents or it's 60 youth, et cetera, and really look at how to re-envision what this future on this planet has got to be. I'm dodging the question. I don't think it's all rotten myself.
Yeah, it's not a lie, but I think it might be a dream. And a dream, that's why Lynn talks about changing the dream, awakening the dreamer. And it's called the American dream for a reason, because we're asleep. and so it's not a lie. It's just that there are equal truths that are coexisting and yet very much competing with one another in how long they can coexist. and we need to wake up. And one of those organizations that I showed in the youth-led, the millennial youth-led slide is called Generation Waking Up.
My answer to that is that the trance that we're in is rooted in unconscious, unexamined assumptions that we don't know we have. And a kind of stunning example comes from our colleague Julia Butterfly Hill, who says, when you throw something away, where is away? There's no such place. That's an unconscious, unexamined assumption. And what's the really good news about unexamined, unconscious assumptions being at the root of the trance, you can find them in your own lives. There have been points of your life where you had an assumption about someone that they were nasty or they were mean or they were, and then you hear their story and everything dissolves and you fall in love with them. Or you hear the truth, or something gets revealed, and things change for you. You can't see them the same anymore. And that's the good news, because we did this to ourselves, and that means we can undo it. And it also means that we're not flawed, which I think is really important as a species, and this is something we say in the symposium. We're not flawed as a species. We are merely mistaken. Badly mistaken, yes. But we can correct. We can correct. We have corrected. So there are things that lies we've told ourselves that are unconscious, unexamined assumption, like there's an away. But it's an unconscious lie. It's not evil. And we can wake up and realize there isn't an away. We have to figure out what to do with all this stuff, et cetera, et cetera. So we're at a time, I think, where turning over the rocks and looking at the things that aren't so pleasant to look at will give us such freedom, such power, and such a relief, really, to see the forest for the trees. And I think that's what's going on the planet right now, and I think it will get us through.
I want to remind our listening audience that we have with us tonight Wilfred Welch, Lynn Twist, and David Hopkins, who are talking to us about the how-tos of social entrepreneurship. Please.
Trying to think how to phrase this. I have this impression, and maybe you all with your international experiences, that countries in Europe have turned this corner toward communitarianism sooner than we have. And I don't know whether it comes from the devastation of World War II and what Europe has gone through. But so it's a very broad question. I'm not phrasing it very well, but maybe you can give us some – maybe there's something we can learn from Europe, or I think of Sweden, I think of some other countries and that I know very little about, but I wondered what your take was on that.
Well, my quick take on that is that you're absolutely right, Ken, that the Europeans have been reluctant to and uncomfortable with the excesses of our own culture and attitudes, and also on such issues as global warming and the restructuring of their own industries to address issues like that have been way ahead of ourselves. And we need to play a little bit of catch-up, and I happen to be a very strong Obama fan, and I think the values that he is demonstrating right now in the actions that he is showing are very much in alignment with playing catch-up and taking leadership around that issue, and I think we have a good shot at bringing about the kind of shifts which are supported by this collapse, which is, as Lynn said, is so painful. But sometimes that's the only way you get there. Unfortunately, you don't get rid of nuclear weapons when just someone talks about it. But when the Cuban Missile Crisis hit, everybody says, ooh. I hope it doesn't take 4-3 million people to die in New York City or San Francisco Underground to go underwater kind of thing for us to wake up to bring about this shift that we need to take place. And hopefully the economic crisis in and of itself will have some of those beneficial effects.
I thought I'd just pass along a tactic I heard from Warren Buffett as reported through Bono, who was talking about when he was starting his, I was thinking of your BeRewarding.com, and what Warren Buffett advised Bono to do is don't appeal to people's sense of duty or shame. Appeal to their greatness.
Their greatness, is that what the
their
word is?
Their greatness, yeah.
Yes. Great.
Beautiful.
Nice, as I said.
Please go ahead.
I am a millennial and am starting to unravel what Lynn has talked about in terms of what my path is in social entrepreneurship. And this follows up with something you suggested about the Commonwealth Club trying to probe. So it's not a fun question, but it's something that's really important to me as I start to look at my path. In international development and health, which is the path I've explored so far, one thing that I keep feeling is that a lot of the resources around social entrepreneurship or development stay in the developed countries. And so one thing that struck me is even in the exciting and wonderful hope, vision, and change that the Commonwealth Club is hosting, all three of the honorees are institutions that are firmly rooted in California and in the United States. My question for the panel is how, in this room, can we be stewards of translating resources, empowerment, opportunities more to institutions that are based in countries that aren't at the global top? And I think certainly Pachamama Institute is an example of that. How else can we further that?
You want to make a comment? Go ahead.
I'll just make a comment about a project that we're working on that is more about transforming our perception of what you're talking about, which I think is also an important part of what I think you're getting at. So I'll just say that it's a little bit different than your question, but I think it applies. Something that is a movement afoot in the world today is relabeling countries from the current label, which is developed, developing, which is a kind of an unfortunate label, and it comes from, in the terms of Pachamama, the dream, you know, the nightmare dream, that developing countries are supposed to develop like the developed countries, and we all know that that's not going to work, it's not appropriate, and they actually don't want to anymore now. And we're trying to undevelop, kind of. So to another terminology, which is ecological creditor nations and ecological debtor nations. Ecological creditor nations are nations who use less biomass than they have available. And ecological debtor nations are countries like our own that use everything we've got, plus have to go outside and get resources from other countries to sustain our lifestyle. The ecological creditor nations, if they got together, if we actually relabeled this, particularly by Copenhagen, which is in December 2009, which is the next big climate change conference, then the ecological creditor nations, if they got together and there's movement afoot that this might be hosted in South America, would then realize that they are the countries that we used to think of as poor. All sub-Saharan Africa is ecological creditor nations. All South America is ecological creditor nations. Some Scandinavian, Finland is, Gabon is. You know, it puts Gabon, Finland, and Brazil in the same category. To have ecological creditor nations realize that they are the holders of the genuine wealth. They may have huge debts in terms of money to the World Bank and the IMF, but they hold the genuine wealth on the planet, the wealth that's absolutely vital for the future of life on Earth. And the ecological debtor nations, if they met under this new construct, would see that their future depends on good relations with the ecological creditor nations who actually hold the power and the cards for the future. So that's one project that we're working on that recalibrates our perception as well as has us begin to see what real resources are and where they are.
Yeah. Some more questions?
I'm going to say that there's obvious interest in this, and so we are going to extend the conversation a short bit here. If you do have to leave, we certainly understand. Please leave quietly. But we are going to continue on for just a bit more. So please, go ahead with your question, sir.
I thought one of the most interesting words uttered in this interesting conversation was Lynn's description of her adherence to the Pachamama opportunity as surrender. And in a way, the same concept came up when you talked about birthing your children, that you get to a certain point and then you surrender to the process. And surrender tends in the Western left brain warrior modality to be something that we avoid And I'd be interested in hearing how you decide which surrenders are justifiable, beneficial, why you chose that surrender, and if either of the other two panelists wants to say something in the same vein.
You're up.
Me?
Mm-hmm. I have no idea. but I would say it's not cognitive, if I can put it that way. It's the surrender of the heart. And one thing that has been really powerful in our work with Indigenous people, and prior to that, my work with peoples in resource-poor countries or ecological creditor nations, I'll now say, is the power of the wisdom of the heart to tell you the honest-to-God truth when you're not sure what to do. And sometimes the pull or the call to respond with your life, not just with a task or some money or a piece of time, but the call to respond with your life is a sign that it's time to surrender. So that's the best I can do. There's no formula, I'm afraid, at least not for me. Thank you.
Excuse me. My name is Hubert Jew. I actually met Wilford at through Heidi and Gary Kuhn. They're featured in your book, For Roots of Peace. My question is, let's say I have an idea for social entrepreneurship. What is the best way, or what are some good ways to, as you know, ideas are very fragile, and I'm thinking, okay, I have this little idea, or maybe it's a big idea, but I'm only one person, and the task seems daunting. What's the best way to gain support and to foster the idea, to share it with like-minded people? How do you grow the idea and make it reality?
Well, a couple of things. In the book, David and I really were very, very conscious. If we're really going to write a book that is going to support people in doing exactly that, let's give them the resources. Mm-hmm. So the last third of the book is all about what those resources are that someone who has an idea and wants to be of service and get engaged, how do they go about it? What are the websites they look at? What are the business schools they might want to consider going into? What are the places like Ashoka and Skoll and Echoing Green and others that they might go to for financing or for advice? Okay. The second thing we did is we created, and I just didn't have the time to put it up here, we created a website. You know, if you sell 50,000 copies of a book like this, you're doing pretty well, but there happen to be 7 billion people on this.
7 billion.
7 billion people on this earth, 6.7 to 7 billion people on this earth. And so we really wanted to get it out, so we created a website in which people can articulate their interests in an initiative and connect with other people around the world who share that interest. So, and we're creating a whole company called Ecoopi to do that and be able to have millions of people and hundreds of thousands of organizations that are already out there seamlessly connect with each other. Mm-hmm. Okay, and there's a lot of social technologies on the internet that are allowing people to be able to do that. So there are organizations, there's literature and research, and there are very good sources of funds that are now coming available.
Yeah. Thanks. Guess I should read your book.
Yeah. Other comments on that one? Or?
And save some money and go to the website, too.
I think that what there needs to be is a Kiva-like program for young social entrepreneurs that can – I think the biggest obstacle is financial. And so if there is a way to institute a lending program around ideas that can be incubated and fostered – as a loan for emerging social entrepreneurs, that to me would be the number one greatest impact. And there are a lot of grant-making organizations that do that, and we have a list of foundations that do give support that are grants. But there isn't enough of the business mind. We need more venture capital in social venture capital. And there's a trend that's showing that's accelerating at an exponential rate, but there is nothing quite like that out there. So I share your plight. As Be Rewarding has been quite difficult to get off the ground, and I've surrendered my life to it. To bring it. And it, anyway.
Please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Siobhan Nealand. I'm the founder of One Mama, and we're an organization that does everything. Helping impoverished women have their babies safely and financial sustainability. And actually, I didn't know I was a social entrepreneur until I met David at my One Mama launch party. And I have read your book, and it's amazing. And I feel like it's just I'm driven, and I really appreciated what you said about the call that it takes your life. And I am crazed with everything that I'm doing. I run three businesses, and all of them are to support this organization. And my biggest problem is time and getting enough people, like almost like Akiva, not just the finances. Like I figured I'm not going to ask anybody for money. I'm just going to make it myself, and I'll support it and get the community to support itself. But now my big problem is getting enough people to get as passionate about it as I am. And if I can get enough time in front of people, usually I can get them. But right, David?
Yeah.
But I don't have that. And what I find is that it's the block of this. You know, I think the economy is helping in a sense. People are starting to wake up from the dream. But what are like maybe three simple things or one simple thing that I can do that I can help penetrate to bring collaboration with other nonprofits that are not so stuck with each other, and also other people who want to volunteer and be of service, but they feel blocked by it. Am I making sense?
I will just make one comment. I'm very, very clear that you've got exactly the most important thing of you saying those three things that is needed, and that is passion. You obviously do, and that people gravitate to a powerful idea and someone who has passion around making it happen. Okay, I've seen it over and over in my life. And I also see that even though you may be frustrated that people aren't gravitating fast enough, we're at this perfect time, I think, in history in this country, in which people are getting very aware about what has to happen and are stepping forward rather rapidly. I mean, the youth, the young leaders now that we've just been talking about, it's amazing. It's amazing what's happening. It's amazing what's happening in what we call the Encore generation, people of my age who have no interest in stopping, okay, just have a lot of energy to continue and want to be of service to people like yourself, whether it's with money or advice. I mean, we were dealing with your friend Morgan Fitzsimmons, Fitzgibbons, just behind you, who is the fellow that started Be Rewarding yesterday. Those guys have got more passion, and they've got good ideas, okay? And that's the most important thing it takes. That's very general, but I feel so deeply about it.
Yeah, I would just say continue to do what you're doing, and I'm not the one to be giving you advice on this because you're actually much further ahead than...
You might give them some money.
All the money I have, right, which I stole from Wilford. What I would say is... I don't know, but Vera Cordeiro, who is the founder of Saúde Criança Renascer, which is in Brazil, she sent out letters. She started a children's health clinic in Rio, outside of Rio, and in 1991, I think it was. And she sent out letters asking for support to 117 foundations and peers around the world, and she got 117 no's. And she said that, wow, I didn't even know they were saying no because it was in a different language. But I was pretty sure because there wasn't a check in there. Fast forward 6, 7, 8 years later, she's Time Woman of the Year in Brazil. And she got a lot of no's, and she said there was one thing that kept her going, and that's persistence.
Yeah. I would say just the same echo. I think you already are this, so I'll say be unstoppable, and you will find the way through. When you're unstoppable and committed beyond what's reasonable, and I can see in your face and the way you're standing at that microphone that you are, nothing will stop you, and you can trust that. Also, this thing called discourage, that's never going to happen to you. Because discouragement means being disconnected from your courage, discouraged, which means disconnected from your heart. If you stay connected to your heart, you'll succeed. There's no question. I have no concerns about you. You're a winner.
Lynn mentioned
you're going to succeed.
Lynn mentioned Unstoppable and Unreasonable, and there's another book about social entrepreneurship by Pamela Hardigan, who wrote the first college curriculum on social entrepreneurship and is now the head of Said Business School for Social Entrepreneurship at Oxford. And her book is called The Power of Unreasonable People. So you got to be unreasonable.
And you are.
We're going to need to bring this to a close pretty quick, but I'm really intrigued by this, and I have been for many, many years, about the word entrepreneurship. And certainly we've used it tonight, and I've noted that we typically talk about this space and this subject matter in matters of energy and passion and heart and almost kind of a spiritual thing in terms of the calling and so forth. Mm-hmm. And certainly Wilfred at the start helped characterize some of the things about social entrepreneurs. But what it brings to mind, and I'd appreciate each of you to comment on this if you would, Babson College back in Massachusetts is quite renowned for their coursework on entrepreneurship. And I'm not that familiar to know if they're more oriented toward the what we would think of typically as the business entrepreneurship or the for-profit entrepreneurship. But I really have always loved that kind of elegant simplicity that they have when they talk about entrepreneurship. And that is, they say entrepreneurship is first and foremost a mindset. It's a mindset that then is three things. It's opportunity obsessed, it's holistic in approach, and it's leadership balanced. So I was curious if you'd comment on that. It almost seems a little dry as compared to some of the things we've talked about tonight in terms of passion and heart and energy and unstoppable and so forth and so on. But anyway, comment if you would.
Do you want to say anything?
Wilfred happens to be quite good friends with the former president of Babson College, so maybe he might comment.
Wing it right back to me. I sat down, I hope this is helpful, I sat down and the easiest piece of the book I wrote in about an hour and a half, I asked myself, what's my advice to someone who wants to get engaged? And I realized that the first thing is the thing we've been talking about over here, passion. The second is to figure out what your skills are that are pertinent to the passion that you have. Okay? It may be fundraising, and it may be accounting and control, and it may be something totally different that is critical to what it takes to be successful. Okay, and then follow that. It may be putting together a team that is necessary, and I put together about sort of five steps. It's very practical, but it really does start with the commitment to something that you are passionate about, and if you're not, then you'll give up the next time something interesting comes along. What is very exciting, you talked about Babson was one of the first universities in the country that did get involved in this entrepreneurship side and social entrepreneurship. Now, most every business school is developing a course on social entrepreneurship. It's growing like this. It's probably the fastest growing of any course, just like Lynn Twist pointed out that the civil society movement is the fastest growing movement in human history. This social entrepreneurs, I look at social entrepreneurs as the sort of the spear point of the civil society movement. It's people who are trying to bring about systemic change using business methods and focusing on market and all the rest to bring about the heart and solve the social environmental problems.
I would just say that I can't even remember the three phrases that you said sounded dry.
Well, it was first of all this mindset notion, right. Which again seems pretty non-passionate in a way, or not necessarily, but anyway, uh-huh. The opportunity obsessed, holistic in approach and leadership balanced, and I'm sure that can be all peeled away. But I was just curious about your reaction to this notion of mindset versus passion and so forth and so on. And maybe they're not exclusive. I just was curious about
you. Yeah, I think that the thing mindset is just a code word for yes. Mm-hmm. Because an entrepreneur succeeds because they're a yes, I can person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love Obama's use in his acceptance speech of "Yes, we can," because it shifted the mindset of a whole nation and ultimately the world from, you know, fear and shutting down and being terrorized to "Yes, we can." No matter what it is, we can beat it. And to me, that is what an entrepreneur needs to do. And it's really, I don't remember your name, but she's a total embodiment of it. I mean, there's no way she's not going to succeed. And her whole body says, "Yes, I can," you know. And, you know, she gave us a problem, but, you know, she knows the answer to that. So I think the paradigm is the key thing. And people who are in that space, in that place, are people who've turned what I call their complaint into a commitment. They've transformed a complaint about the world into a commitment. And that is a paradigm shift, because the content's still the same, but you don't have time to complain about it anymore because you're resolving the thing. And that's a paradigm shift, and I think that's the key of the three that you said.
You know, Rich, I want to make one more comment. There's a woman named Charlotte DeVita in the book, and she's in London. And she made a very interesting comment on this. She said, "I went to Richard Branson, and I asked him if he could help me. He said, 'How many times have you failed?' She said, 'What?' He said, 'I'm not going to work with anybody who hasn't failed twice, got up, and got going again.'" So that's a mindset about what it takes to have that determination, that persistence, that clarity of vision, and that passion that will take one through. And, you know, many people think, "Gee, if I fail, I'm done for." And he was saying it's a qualification for getting on with it.
Well, we appreciate your passionate persistence tonight. And so we're going to endeavor to get these three questions, and then we'll draw things to a close. So I hope perhaps that they're brief, but please go ahead.
Yeah, great question. I'd actually like to just build upon that. Regarding the nature of entrepreneurs, and in particular social entrepreneurism. Oh, sorry. Regarding the nature of social entrepreneurism, I have this perception that it's more often affiliated with nonprofits. And so the question that I have is, can a business be socially entrepreneurial, a for-profit business? And in terms of the nuts and bolts of it, for social entrepreneurs who are trying to address social and economic problems, how should you structure, for-profit or nonprofit?
Well, certainly, social entrepreneurs are very often for-profit organizations. The Pachamama Alliance is not. You know, Van Jones and what he started up at Oakland is not. Many of them, like a Room to Read, are not. But a great many of them are, and I really encourage that. And I encourage young people to recognize that they don't have to be poor to be. When I was young, you know, I had no choice. If you really wanted to be of service, you either gave up your life and put on a hair shirt, or you worked very hard and then gave it away at the end of your life. Now there's no reason why people can't do good and do well at the same time. I think that corporations have a lot to learn from social entrepreneurs and are learning it. These notions of collaboration, these notions of jumping across barriers and thinking about who you operate with, for-profits dealing with nonprofits to solve their problems. A lot is going on in the business community. They're moving relatively fast in these areas, one, because they have no choice, because of transparency. People are pushing them pretty hard.
Also, if any of you have read any of John Perkins' books, Lynn happens to be quite good friends with him, I believe, because he writes about her in his best-selling books. That's the only reason I know that. John Perkins has written a few books, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and The Secret of the American Empire, The Truth of Jackals and Economic Hitman, and so on and so forth. And what he's not alone in this, of course. What he talks about is the great shift that business and corporations, the corporatocracy, he calls it, must make. They're the ones, largely, who have caused the problems. Therefore, they are the ones who must be a part of the solution. And in the book, we have a section on intrapreneurship, in which entrepreneurs are working on their own often and bringing in players into their idea. As an intrapreneur, you go, you work for a company, like Wilford's nephew, who worked for Shell oil. And Wilfred said, why? And he said, well, because I want to change it from within. And in order to really systemically tackle fishing, deforestation, climate change, the automobile industry, you know, you name it, you gotta somehow get into the business realm using market forces, as Wilfred so often says, to change mass global practices that need to be shifted. So, of course, business is key to that.
Please go ahead. Thank you. I just have a short comment, sort of fitting with the theme of the evening, talking about the birth, the sort of pain of our moment, the pain of the economy, and sort of needing to help the death of this old way of being and a birth of a new one. Some words of wisdom from one of my professors at the California Institute of Integral Studies in the program called Philosophy, Cosmology, and Consciousness. Dr. Rick Tarnas says, all pain is birth pain. So I just wanted to share that with you guys.
Thank you. Please, last question,
yes.
Please.
My name is Elizabeth LaRose, and I am director at Headlands Institute, where Wilfred is my board chair. And I'd like for you to include that next time you give him an intro. He is my board chair. Headlands is, yes.
Good. Thank you for mentioning I worked that. With him almost every day, and I did hear a lot about it, so I know that he's focused on it.
Thank you.
I'm totally focused on it. It's very relevant to what we're talking about tonight.
Right. And we do hugely important work, which is connecting children to the youth to the natural world, which in this day and time with overscheduling and the kinds of worlds we've exposed them to, it's hugely, hugely important, I think, so they can help be that millennium generation. That said, I am between the millennium and the encore generations, and I think many of us in this room and many of us who are your audiences are in that generation. We're less likely to go out and start social entrepreneurial organization, but we are in organizations or businesses that do good and really want to be a part of that change. That said, my question is, what can we do from this position? We may not be starting this, but from where we sit, there's a tremendous amount that we could be doing, and what I like is your wisdom. I can get Wilfred's individually, but I'd really like to see what he says in a group like this, as well as the other two of you. What can we be doing to really imbue our organizations or our businesses with this thought of being part of that birthing process or being the midwife that really helps to bring this change along? That's my question.
And as we answer this last question, I'd ask each of you to perhaps briefly tag on, in perhaps in your response or embed in your response, some final thoughts that you'd like us to leave with tonight as we all leave to ponder the things we've talked about.
Yeah. Any comments?
Well, what I'll say is Lynn may very well say this herself, but have your organizations go to the symposium.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have not done it yet. Xander...
I'll sign if you do the symposium.
Okay, yeah, well, we're going to trade. She's going to sign on Be Rewarding, and I'll go to the symposium. That's a pretty easy answer for me. But she can probably speak more to that. Do you want to say why that would be so valuable?
Go ahead, and I will say something.
Okay. That's it.
Oh, my God. Okay, so, yes, you should go to the symposium. It'll really work. Or have us deliver it in your organization. That's a really great idea. I didn't even think of that. But I would say that... do you want to do your closing thing?
Oh, do my closing thing too? Oh, okay. So I realized there was one thing I didn't really explain in my presentation, and that was the R of task era. And the R is right brain. And I wanted to say why very briefly. Daniel Pink, who I mentioned, writes A Whole New Mind, and I was very inspired by what he had to say at a pop tech conference in Camden, Maine. And he said, left and right brain. Left brain, these are generalizations, are analytical, logical, analysis, quantitative driven. And right brain is more synthesizing, feeling, emotional intelligence. And he said he wanted to make the paradigm between the brain hemispheres and the economy shift that we're undertaking. And that if you wanted to say that since the Industrial Revolution, machines have replaced our bodies, one might say that software is replacing our left brains in the new era in which we're living, which is logic and quantitative and these more routinized skills. And he's a very left-brain person, by the way. And he says that these skills are being shipped overseas and so on and so forth. The right brain is what he believes is needs to be the future of where we're going, and that is emotional intelligence, feeling, these things that can't be taken over by computers. They can't be taken over by our iPods and our iPhones and our machines. It's what makes us human. It's what makes us feel. It's what makes social entrepreneurs have their passion. And so that's the right brain of the task era, and that's something that I am working on and want to leave you with.
Wow, that was so good. Let's see. I think that we all, in every business, in every enterprise, in every life, really, need to look and see how to reallocate our resources away from that which is destructive, consumptive, materialistic, and ultimately destroying the very fabric of life. And we're all fueling that every day. And withdraw resources, financial and human resources, from those activities, those projects, those enterprises, and reallocate those same resources towards life, towards the affirmation of life, towards the health and well-being of our planet, of one another, and the natural environment in which we live. And so I think there's just massive resources. We need to reallocate them away from fear, away from death, away from destruction, away from consumption, and towards that which sustains and supports life, that which we love, actually. And that's philanthropy. That's paying attention to how you're using your money and your time. It's waking up, really. So that's one thing. And then, you know, I think it's really a time where you want to be known for what you allocate, not for what you accumulate. I think it's time to make it illegitimate. Society gives legitimacy, and society can take it away. It used to be totally legitimate. There would have been ashtrays everywhere in here, and a lot of you would have been smoking probably 30 years ago. Now it would be horrifying if someone lit up a cigarette in here. None of us would be able to function. We really wouldn't. I mean, think about that. That's a huge change. And the people who gave up smoking, and I'm sure many of you did, some people say it's the hardest thing they've ever done in their whole life. They didn't give it up for health reasons. They gave it up because they were embarrassed, because it became illegitimate to light up a cigarette. So it's just humiliating to do it now. So we don't. I never did smoke myself. But I can tell my sisters and my brother and my parents smoked, and it was hard for them to give it up. So society gives legitimacy, and society can take it away. And there's nothing more powerful than making actions that really don't work illegitimate and legitimizing actions that do work. And then finally, I would say, just because here we are in the Commonwealth Club, the real wealth is the Commonwealth, the wealth that's common to all of us, the Commonwealth.